Mark Helprin is the critically acclaimed best-selling author of Winter's Tale, In Sunlight and in Shadow, and A Soldier of the Great War, among others. His new novel is Paris in the Present Tense, whose protagonist, Jules Lacour, is a man in his 70s, a professional cellist, a survivor of the Holocaust, living a quiet life in Paris when he has to confront a series of emergencies and confront his own ideas about right and wrong. So, Mark, you've written about aging before, and Soldier of the Great War, that was an old man looking back on his life. But age and mortality seem to be central in this book. So how have your ideas about aging and dying, how have those been changing, and how do you see them expressed by Jules?
They've been changing because I've gotten old. And what's happened is that a lot of the things that I thought when I was young, that I imagined that would apply to someone who was old, now I have experienced. And I was pretty accurate then. For example, in this book, in 1968, I was about 20. I had a vision of what was happening to Paris when it was torn apart by almost a revolution. The students were in the streets. There were barricades, burning buses. It was tremendously disruptive of daily life. And at the verge of revolution, I had a friend who was the most unwarlike person I've ever known. He was a department head, and he was issued a pistol. He didn't have the vaguest idea of what to do with it, but he was supposed to defend his département. But anyway, I had a sort of a vision at that time, which was of a golden fire, like the pillar of fire in the Bible, rising above Paris, accompanied by the music of Couperin, a harpsichord piece called Les Barricades Mystérieuses. And I wanted to write about that at the time, and I tried. But I couldn't because I didn't have the experience, and I didn't have the wisdom of the world. I mean, the experience of the world, and I had to wait for half a century in order to actually bring that to what I hope is a good, convincing reality.
Were you living in Paris at that time?
No, but I had spent so much of my life, not so much, but a great deal of my life in Paris. My father moved us there when I was three. And when I was three and four, this was just after the war, and there was not too much of a change because war production had not shifted over entirely to civilian production, so that the styles, the cars, the architecture, commercial products were very much the way they were before the war and during the war. It was fresh in people's minds. There were ruined buildings all over the place and bullet holes in stores and other buildings. And the destruction of the war was apparent. And when you're three and four, I think, is the time when you cease to become the center and what's around. And you realize that there's a world around you which is the center and you're simply periphery to it. You're one part of it because you're no longer an infant. You're no longer the center of the world. And I happened to be in Paris at the time. So for me, Paris is like the Omphalos, the stone in Delphi, which the Greeks thought was the center of the world. I've always thought of it as the center of the world, even though I'm an American.
Did it feel like home, sort of?
Yeah, it feels like the home that I should actually have. I mean, I've had a lot of those. I've lived in 45 different places. That's the first one where I actually realized that I was not the world, but only a part of it.
And the Paris that you describe, you're not at the Eiffel Tower, you're not in the famous tourist parts of Paris, you're in the quiet residential neighborhoods of Paris in this book. Mm-hmm. You seem very familiar with it.
When I go to any kind of city, a foreign city, certainly American city, I don't go usually where the tourists go because I don't think that you can buy a ticket to culture. What you can buy a ticket to, you know, get into a museum, hear a concert. The things that you can buy a ticket to are the product of culture. Culture is what makes those things. And I think people make a mistake. If they want to see the culture of France, they just tour churches and museums and things. But that's not what the real culture is. The real culture is the magical thing that has made those things. And that you can find in the everyday life of the people, or in the extraordinary life of the people. So when I go to a city, I go to the suburbs, I go to schools, I go to factories, parks, roads, etc., where the people live, and that's where you can really observe the culture. In this book, you don't have too much, although there's the Eiffel Tower is on the cover, which is very nice, mm-hmm. but you don't go to the Eiffel Tower in this book. Instead, you go where Parisians go.
You decide to talk about anti-Semitism.
It's a tremendous problem in France. France has lots of problems. But essentially, France, there's an enormous problem of violence and an unassimilated country that is within France. And as we know, this creates ongoing problems, and they haven't been able to solve them. One byproduct of it is anti-Semitism in France, in which the traditional anti-Semitic right, such as the far right in Marine Le Pen's party, the National Front, has allied with the anti-Semitic people of Arabic origin, such as Dieudonné, who is a comedian, and he his main joke is the Holocaust. His real name is Mabala Mabala. But anyway, it's very dangerous for Jews in France now. Many have left. Jews are killed, tortured. They're afraid to walk on the street with anything that identifies them. And there are essentially zones in France which are, they call them non-Zionist zones. Mm. But what they are really is like Judenfrei zones.
And you felt like this was urgent enough that your character, Jules, in this book had to confront this in modern day Paris.
Well, he didn't have to confront it. It confronted him. Mm-hmm. He in fact, he says that he's not, he doesn't want to fight any more battles. He's 74 years old. He was a product of the Holocaust, as anyone who reads the book will see. He's a direct product of it. And he doesn't have to fight every battle, and he's too old. In France, the word for retirement is retraite, which means retreat. They speak of people who are in retraite. And he has retreated, but it finds him. It finds him, and mortality finds him, not only his own, but that of his little grandson who has leukemia. And that's the heart of the book, is how he can try to protect the lives of lives of his daughter and his grandson, particularly the grandson who is actually dying, in the way that he could not protect, because he was 4 years old, the lives of his parents who were shot in front of him. And by the way, I know this very, very closely, because when we did live in Paris and subsequently in the United States, we were very close to people who had survived the Holocaust. My father, in fact, brought a French family over to rescue them. And we had many people who had experienced this, including I knew two people who saw their parents killed in front of them. One at a very young age, and he's now actually in an institution because he's schizophrenic and kind of hopeless. And the other managed to pull himself together, but he never could really get over that. Who could? And he's long dead. And you'll see one of them anyway in the dedication of the book.
You mentioned Jules is a child of the Holocaust, and his life is so defined by the events when he was a child, but he can't explain this to his only child, his beloved daughter, because he doesn't want to burden her. So she's put off by his strangeness in the world.
Yes, I have the experience of having children who are put off by my strangeness, so that was easy. Mm. But it's very hard to describe that. Just to give you an example, my father, we're both Jewish. I was in the Israeli Army and Air Force. He volunteered at age, he was over age in World War II. He essentially was, he was not technically in the OSS, but he worked directly for Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, who founded the OSS, because Donovan had been his lawyer before the war. And he was trained at Camp X as a commando. There were he did astounding things in the war, and so the two of us were anything but Nazis, and we used to walk near his house in north of New York, and there was a man who was a Holocaust survivor, and we would pass him every once in a while, and he had a big German Shepherd dog that was a real guard dog, and he carried a club, and when he would pass us, he would grip the club, as if he had to fight us. And I thought at the time, well, this is obviously crazy. But then I was told that he was a Holocaust survivor, and I fully understand it. It's not something that you can really convey. Although I have to say that one of the things that distinguishes Jules is that he refuses to be a victim. of this. You know, he lives his life, I hate to use the word, but passionately, in terms of his devotion to music and beauty and his children. He feels, as I feel, that our duty to the people who perished in the Holocaust is to live the life that they could not live, to appreciate it and to take full advantage of living, and not to be neurotic about it. And also to refuse to be a victim in all cases. There's no reason why anyone who can possibly fight needs to be a victim.
So talk a little bit more about that relationship between Jule and his daughter. Why did you decide to put that pain on Jule?
Well, when parents have a separation from children, it's one of the most painful things that you can imagine. I mean, your children are really the only thing that you have. Your career is nothing. There's no such thing as immortality. Eventually, even Shakespeare and Mozart will be forgotten. Eventually, everything turns into a cinder. The eternity is what we have to measure everything against. And the only fortification that we have against the despair of eternity is essentially love and the continuation of a chain of life that began at the beginning, which is expressed in every person. And the closest thing to that is your own child. So that's a topic that is deeply emotional and deeply important. Jule is someone who is beset by things that are deeply emotional and deeply important. And that, by the way, is one of the differences between this book and all my books and certain modern conventions, in which a book has to be more or less like a tight, restricted magazine article, you know, because of people's attention span, because of the bleed over from the academy, where you have a intense limitation. So you get the PhD theses on, paper clips as a metaphor for feigned consent in Belgian circus stories. and this is spread to fiction writing and to what may be called literature. It's just sort of like a blog almost these days. One topic, one theme, you explore it, a magazine article, that's it. I don't think a novel should be that way. I think a novel should be something which proceeds through and across many strata. And so that in the end, the sum is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah. Let me just read you one thing from the very beginning of your book, because I know, Mark, you're never afraid to tackle the big concepts and the big ideas. And the very beginning of the book, you're talking about Jule. He was a cellist and could never have been anything else. The world had courage, faith, beauty, and love, and it had music. And I thought, well, there you go. Those are the themes that we're going to see in this book and that you often play on.
Yeah, and particularly music, too, because I'm a frustrated musician. In other words, not a musician who would love to have been a musician, but I didn't have the talent. I can hear things in my head, but there's no way that I'd be able to write them down.
Well, you do describe music a lot in this book as a way of expressing humanity in a way that can't be expressed any other way.
That's right. I mean, I think that music is the most ineffable art, and it, as I say in the book somewhere, I think that it takes you as far to heaven as is possible to get without dying. Jules says it's the voice of God, but you could also think of it as the remnant voice of God. Whatever it is so extraordinary that it deserves a great deal of reflection. I reflected in the book upon music. He does, because he's a professional, as much as I possibly could, trying to solve the mystery of what it is that's so magnificent about it. Of course, I never got there, but I got maybe close.
Yeah. And you say a few times in the book, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have it in front of me, but something along the lines that passion should be reserved for art and reason for politics, but things now have become the opposite.
Exactly the opposite. And it's very damaging because art has become, well, nihilistic and cold and analytical. And then politics has now become unreasonably passionate to the point where it's damaging. And those things should be reversed. One should be able to sit down with someone of the opposite political faith and have a reasonable discussion. I used to do that. You certainly did that in graduate school, where I was in those fields. And I mean, for instance, I was in the Israeli Army and Air Force. I was able to sit down and have dinner with Rashid Khalidi, who was in the PLO. We could talk about things. And this is very hard these days. We seem to have lost that, and that's a great pity, because what it does is it drives us into kind of doghouses of our own belief.
You know, it strikes me when you talk about things that were. There's something that I underlined here in the book with Jules, and he's talking about loyalty. He says, loyalty is like magic. It makes suffering immaterial. You're loyal to what? Being peculiar? No, I'm loyal to a world that was destroyed. Do you feel that way?
Yes, in the sense that I'm loyal to my parents, and they're dead. And I think about them all the time, and will never forget them. And I feel a love toward them, which will only vanish when I'm dead. And it's something which does fortify you and give you a purpose. And I'm also loyal to, without being nostalgic, because I don't like nostalgia. It's a surface emotion. But I am loyal to certain things that have vanished, certain customs and ways of life. Yes, I am. And also, I'm resistant to fashion, because fashion is simply something that becomes old-fashioned. And then is rejected the same way that fashionable people will reject previous fashions. So what you have to look for, what I look for, is the universal, things that last through time, things that are fundamental, and which are not subject to the whim of a popular fashion. And as far as loyalty goes, also, there's a whole section of the book called Loyal Amour, which is a pun in French. Loyal amour, meaning loyalty to death, more. But amour, of course, means love. So it's a pun in the same way that the title is a pun, Paris in the present tense. Mm-hmm. And lots of things in the book are puns, like, for instance, the insurance salesman, the fat insurance salesman, Armand Hammer. Excuse me.
gave it away.
Armand Marteau. Mm-hmm. Marteau means hammer in French. So it's arm and hammer.
Which I only knew because I listened to your podcast with Jay Nordlinger.
Oh, I see.
So I thought, well, I didn't know what Mark, please. You expect a lot of your reader, Mark.
Well, that's another thing. I often, for instance, if you look on Amazon reviews, they're spectacular reviews, except for one or two. And even in the spectacular reviews, people say, well, the sentences are too long, and it uses big words, and it's too complicated. Again, that's a symptom of the short attention span. You know, people these days have been pushed toward having the attention span of a firecracker, and this because of technology and because of the way children are brought up. That's something that I do expect a lot of my readers, and that's an old-fashioned thing. The 19th century novel was essentially a doorstopper, and you had to put some work into it in order to get some value out. And in fact, that's a universal law of the universe. There is no free lunch. You won't get anything out of a book or a piece of music or whatever if you don't put some work into it. Work being attention, understanding, even time. But if you do that, you're in a far better position than you are if you don't, and you just have a sort of junk food entertainment. But I think that people who can appreciate classical music, which takes some education and some work, would appreciate this book very much.
You know, we've been friends for a while, and I know that you are a natural storyteller, and you've been writing since you were very, very young. And I also know that you can be shy. You've described it in interviews I've seen as a social phobia, even.
Yes.
Do you think one goes with the other?
Yeah, because there's really nothing much that I'm suited for other than sitting alone and writing stuff down.
Well, I disagree with that.
Well, it's a miracle. It's a miracle that I've actually been able to make a living doing that. I didn't expect to, so I got into another profession as well, which most writers of the past have done, and it helps because then you don't have to write just about writing. You can write about the things and challenges and defeats that you've experienced in the world. But I happen to have lucked in terms of being able to make a very good living writing books.